Hello and a very warm welcome to Centre Stage. Good to have you with us. Now, last month's Geneva II talks marked the first negotiations between the opposing sides since the start of the three-year conflict, which, according to the UN, has killed more than 130,000 people and forced more than 9 million to flee their homes. Now, in the meantime, Qatari Foreign Minister Khalid bin Mohammed Al Attiyah says the Islamic Republic can play a key role in the resolution of Syria crisis. Welcome back. Now, today we're delighted to be joined by two guests. Now, here in the studio, we're joined by a well-established analyst and researcher. He's also a professor of international relations and politics. Dr. Rahmat Haji Mina, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Centre Stage.
It's my pleasure to be here again.
Thanks very much indeed. Dr. Rahmat Haji Mina is also a top researcher with the Middle East Centre affiliated to the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Now, via Skype from Wisconsin in the US, I have the pleasure of being joined by an established political scientist. Professor Alireza Abutalibi, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
The UN has killed more than 130,000 people and forced more than 9 million to flee their homes. In the meantime,
okay, I think probably we have a bit of a problem having Professor Abutalibi's voice, but of course we have our guest's picture. Hopefully this problem will be resolved after this short break. So please do stay with us.
Syria is still in the limelight, and this time round because of deadlock talks in Geneva, which took 10 days to complete and which virtually came to nothing concrete. Syria's government and opposition began the so-called Geneva II talks on January 22nd, with the participation of dozens of nations, including Russia, which backs the government, and the United States, which supports the opposition, but without a very influential player, namely Iran. Meanwhile, the United Nations Secretary General pressed the US and Russia to help ensure that peace talks aimed at stemming Syria's civil war can soon resume, while Russia's foreign minister said on Saturday that it was very difficult to push Syrian President Bashar Assad's government to make concessions. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told a conference of global security officials in Munich that he urged Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and US Secretary of State John Kerry at a meeting on the sidelines to use their influence to ensure the talks proceed as scheduled on February 10th. Ban urged the warring parties to come back with more sense of earnestness as well as seriousness and urgency. Specifically, he called on both sides and the government in particular to allow the unfettered access required under international humanitarian law. An agreement to allow aid convoys into the central Syrian city of Homs has remained stalled, with the government and opposition accusing each other of holding up the aid delivery into the city, which has been under siege for nearly 2 years. Lavrov insisted Russia can do nothing alone and urged the United States and others to exert their influence on the Syrian opposition. In an exclusive interview with Arabic-language Al Jazeera News Network on Monday, Qatari Foreign Minister Khalid bin Mohammed Al Attiyah stated Iran remains a major playmaker and its involvement in any negotiations or initiatives aimed at ending the Syrian conflict is essential. That's quite a thought-provoking remark, which clearly refers to what was badly missing in Geneva last week.
Hello again, it's great to have you back with us. Now, Syria's warring sides have traded barbs over the failure to achieve concrete results at peace talks in Geneva. Now, Professor Abutalibi, who's to blame for Geneva II deadlock, do you think?
I'm afraid I'm not hearing you too well, but I'm guessing that your question is about Geneva II and what it failed.
Right. Actually, I was asking that basically we all know that Geneva II talks ended in deadlock. The question I put to you was that who's to blame for that deadlock?
Well, there's plenty of blame to go around. The opposition obviously continue insisting on a kind of preconditions that there will be no future for existing President Bashar Assad's in the future. And of course, not being open to helping people who are being besieged in the city of Homs. And on the part of the government, of course, you know, it's pretty a hard pill to swallow to negotiate with opposition, which is not unified. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of disunity within the opposition. And the government of Syria cannot obviously accept any notion that the negotiation is conditioned upon no future for existing government. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that is too harsh for them. So the opposition, I would say, is bearing much of the blame for being uncompromising, because at this point, I think the major focus should be on a ceasefire, on lifting the siege on city of Homs and other areas, and humanitarian help, setting the stage for the next round of discussions as to put the parameters for negotiations. Because right now, as the negotiation has been kind of has not been going anywhere, there are people actually dying and starving and are in urgent need of medical care. So that should be the priority for everyone.
Great. Thank you very much indeed for that. Now, we actually know that no ceasefire was agreed as the talks ended on Friday. Talks on a transitional government never began, and a deal to allow aid into besieged rebel-held areas of the central city of Homs, as Professor Abutel mentioned, is a very critical issue. Also, in that case, Dr. Haji Mina, it went nowhere.
As you mentioned, in reality, the conference, the Geneva conference, have agreed on nothing substantial for two sides, and it's related to some really reasons that related to both sides. I think the government, delegation went to Geneva not to just really negotiate about transitional government, which the other part of Geneva conference really stressed and tried to speak about transitional government with full power. But what was obvious from the onset, I think that what this point that the government delegation have no intention to speak about transitional government. And the other point is that I think the delegation from opposition really it was very weak, and they asked the governmental delegation I think express valid question about the credential of them, that they are not really representative of the people of Syria. So it was really showed that they cannot come to an agreement about a future plan. But about humanitarian relief, initially they come to this agreement that they try really to do something about Homs, really, and come to a provisional and initial understanding about this idea. But in the reality, they cannot really come to agreement about how and which step they should take for carry out this, I think, agreement.
Right, but you know, I understand that probably it was difficult to agree whether President Assad should go or not. But when it comes to humanitarian relief, to be honest with you, I don't see any major reason why that shouldn't come to any conclusion.
Yeah, as I mentioned, at initial, I think they come to provisional and initial, I think, understanding that this, I think, steps should be taken, but they cannot find any viable and really viable step to carry out this, I think, step, because in reality, the situation in Syria is very complicated, and it's not just to really opening a corridor for going humanitarian relief, but it is related to which side try to control that, which side try to really be surveillance of this act. And I think at first, as you mentioned, that both sides blame each other, but the other part of blame, I think that it's a very, some observer are critical of that.
Right.
It's about the role of, I think, Akhbar Ibrahimi or any international organization to sponsor this, I think, negotiation, because the negotiation right went to the cumbersome, I think, point of a transitional government, which was very difficult and really challenging point of this agreement. I think they should start from very less, I think, contradictional or some challenging, for example, about making or building some trying to do some confidence building and try to find some common ground about how to do or how to really conduct some, as you mentioned, humanitarian relief or release some detainees between each other. They should start from the easy point to a very difficult point.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, Professor Abu Talib, we were just talking here in our Tehran studio with Dr. Haji Mina, and actually he also mentioned that not any concrete conclusions actually were reached after 10 days of talk. So when it comes basically to the rebel head areas of the central city of Homs, where we have really big problems and people, as you said, are starving and the situation is really very catastrophic, they couldn't even reach an agreement when it came to that. So, you know, at first glance, it seems that there shouldn't be much, it shouldn't be much of a problem to reach an agreement to just allow humanitarian aid to go in.
Well, yeah, there should not be much of an issue. But my guess is the opposition might look at that as the first concession if they agree to this. Therefore, they're resisting the notion. They want to continue emphasizing what's going to happen after the agreements and what role President Bashar Assad would play. I think they are deflecting the notion, the humanitarian urgency, and sticking with the political kind of future of political settlements in Syria. One way to induce the opposition, I would argue, to cooperate further is to make it clear that international support for the opposition would wane should they continue this path to negotiation. That's why I think yesterday President Secretary of State John Kerry's proposition that there should be a parallel kind of line of discussion involving U.S., Russia, Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia is constructive.
Right.
I think if they go on that path, and slowly, I think United States is coming to realize that this kind of infiltration of weapons and support to the opposition is being counterproductive. And the Saudis must come aboard, making it clear that the opposition should soften up on its position a bit. The future of Mr. Assad shall be determined by upcoming elections. You know, if we have a clean election supervised by the United Nations, that would determine who's going to hold what kind of power. That should not be the main focus of negotiation at this point.
So basically you mentioned the proposal which basically, according to which five countries will participate in a sort of similar talks. Do you think that this new proposal would basically mean that Geneva II talks they couldn't agree on something concrete, and that's the reason why they've suggested another series of talks with its participants being Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the U.S., and Russia?
I think so. I mean, that there was obviously after a few days of talk, there was clear signals that this thing was not going anywhere. And should that install, the you know, further human suffering will pursue. So at this juncture, if the major actors involved, the five you mentioned, right, are having this kind of argument, I think if the United States come aboard, further being convinced that within the opposition, there are groups which are, who are not acceptable to play a role in the future of Syrian politics, and should that signal resonate, and then should this flow of arms to opposition slow down or completely stop at a certain point, then opposition obviously would be further induced to at least to accept the parameters that humanitarian aid should follow first, then by, you know, first ceasefire, humanitarian aid, and then negotiation over the logistics of elections and the role of Mr. Assad in that election. And if the opposition is well prepared to participate in the future of Syria, they should not fear any elections. Should that election be clean and supervised by United Nations? So at this point, again, I think that second route in terms of getting other actors involved is important. And Kerry's proposal further testified to the United States realization that, again, this thing must can be approached from a different angle. And at this point, again, the flow of arms into the hands of opposition is a major issue.
Right. Very briefly, Professor Abu Talabi, you mentioned the elections. Do you think that considering the current situation, the sorry state of affairs in Syria, do you think that an imminent election is really probably a practical solution to the problem? Can it really happen?
No, obviously we cannot have an imminent elections. I would say we need at least 6 months to a year before any viable election can take place. But within that time interval, we could increase humanitarian aid to the population. And United Nations can establish itself in order to provide for a viable election. And then we'll take it from there on. But no immediate election cannot take place in the midst of misery and warfare. So we need at least, I would say, 6 months to a year.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Now let's take a short break. After the break, we'll continue our discussion on the sorry state of affairs in Syria. And of course, we'll be talking about the outcome of Geneva 2 talks. So please just stay with us. Hello again, good to have you back with us. Now, a disappointing development is that the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said nearly 1,900 people had been killed since the talks began a week ago. Dr. Hajimini, this is really a very shocking figure. Just over the course of 10 days, about 2,000 people being killed.
Yeah, absolutely, it's true. And unfortunately, this report showed that alongside with the conference peace talk, in the battleground, the fighting will continue, and it really demonstrate and show the reality that the group who really starting attack or fighting have no real belief in really in peace talking, in negotiation, and they didn't respect negotiation, and they try to really gain their interest on the battleground, and in by this means they show that they don't respect not only really the peace process, but also really the result and outcome of such negotiation. And they because it's I think in the future will happen again, because there are really very, I think, dramatic really gap between opposition and before, I think, the starting of negotiation in Geneva too, some, I think, faction and some member of opposition withdraw from the main, I think, group, and this showed the real, I think, difference and real problem that is exists between oppositional group that consists of numerous, I think, faction.
Great. We got some unconfirmed media reports that U.S. Congress had secretly approved some, you know, resuming weapon deliveries to moderate Syrian rebel factions.
Yeah.
What's your take on that?
I think, as a matter of fact, U.S. by this, I think, course of action tried, I think, initially to distance from the radical groups which previously tried to work with them, but by their, I think, the radical group by their act and especially by committing some violence showed that they are not acceptable for international community. So U.S. government tried to distance from this radical group and shift its, I think, position toward more moderate group and try to really invest on them and really by this rearming and supporting them, I think U.S. government tried to exert pressure on Syrian government and indirectly try to really pressure on Moscow and Tehran really to convince Syrian government to go to more negotiations.
Right, okay. Thank you very much indeed for that. Now, actually, we know that in an exclusive interview with Arabic language Al Jazeera News Network on Monday, Qatari Foreign Minister stated that Iran remains a major playmaker and its involvement in any negotiations or initiatives aimed at ending the Syrian conflict is essential. Professor Abu Talbi, that's a very interesting remark made by the top Qatari diplomat.
Yes, it would be. Of course, Qatar has been an interesting player in the midst of all this in the last few years or so, trying to inject and a kind of a policy orientation which matters to the region and really going beyond his size and his role in the region. But I think Qatar has its own issues in terms of vision for the future of the region with the Saudi Arabia. Qatar is, you know, in the past supported the Muslim Brotherhood, and to their disappointment, of course, Muslim Brotherhood is not in power in Egypt, and of course the connection with the Hamas, etc., has been shattered somewhat. So Qatar also would like to, again, its own to play a major role in terms of policy of the region. So it's not a drastic point of departure. Maybe it's an opportunism for the Qatari regime, but at any rate, it can be a positive step, admitting that, again, the whole region is going under drastic changes. If you think about it, in a way, in looking at the big picture, in terms of United States relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel, and trying to reach an agreement with Iran over its nuclear program, and trying to tame a situation in Syria, all of this to me indicating, on top of what's happening, of course, in Egypt and Libya and Yemen and the rest of the Arab world, that there is indeed a tsunami of changes happening in the region. These are long-term projects. I think Qataris would like to come along with that. They're maybe realizing further that the quote-unquote the Saudi solution to the situation in Syria is not the solution. Even Turkey has seen that light, and we can see Turkey reposition itself when it comes to that situation. That's what I think the momentum is there with Kerry's proposal for these five countries to get together. Saudis, they need not to be the odd man out. They can come aboard and see the situation from a longer perspective, that indeed forces of moderation can take over in Syria, and the future of Syria can be as such that it can be incorporated into the larger Arab world, which again, in a way, would add further pressure on Israel to come up with a solution to the Palestinian issue. And I think that momentum in Qatar does realize that, and Saudis need to realize that as well.
Do you think that, Professor Abu Talabi, briefly, do you think that what's happening at the moment, we have, you know, Qatari Foreign Minister making some very thought-provoking statements. You know, we have Turkey probably getting back to its, original policy of zero problems with neighbors. Do you think that probably all these recent developments have to do with the fact that they're thinking to themselves that, okay, if Assad goes, who is going to replace him?
I'm sorry, to replace...
They're asking themselves this question. Okay, just imagine that Assad goes. Who's going to replace him?
Right. Obviously, that's the $22 million question. I mean, if this regime falls, what is the future of Syria? And that is what everybody should contemplate. The same argument was heard when it came to Saddam Hussein and what would have happened after Saddam's overthrown. So absolutely, that's a major question, and that the United States and the Russians and the rest have to realize that the alternative at this point is not well positioned, because within the opposition there are obviously factions which are ultra conservative, we call it maybe Takfiris, and they are not the best model for a modern state. And you know, given the situation in Egypt, in the neighboring states, the instability, spillover effect from Syria to Iraq, all that necessitate rethinking about a better way to govern Syria in the future. And opposition must pay dues, really, in proving itself that it can be a viable opposition. And the first thing it can do is to cleanse themselves from these Takfiri elements within the opposition, and to propose themselves as viable alternatives.
Okay.
And the Americans, the Canadians, and the Russians, and the Turks, et cetera, they are all need to see that.
Thank you very much. Now, we know that the country's main Western-backed opposition leader, Ahmed al-Jabra, head of the Syrian National Coalition, visited Moscow yesterday. So, Dr. Hajimina, that's a very interesting development. What message do you think the Russians are trying to send by letting the opposition visit them?
Yeah. Actually, it's very interesting, I think, development from the starting of crisis in March, as in 2011 in Syria, because it was happened for the first time that opposition leader went to Russia based on the invitation of Russian, especially foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. And the message of this, I think, invitation and this visit is very, I think, clear. It showed that Russia tried to play more active role in the Syrian crisis, because Russia from the onset crisis tried to play a great role and very active role on one side, tried to support Syrian government and try I think to use its right in Security Council to veto any sanction against Syrian government. But by this, I think, initiative, Russia tried to really exert its, pressure or its power on the opposition side and try to work with them to find a common ground for any political resolution. Because
you think they can find common ground?
Because I think that Geneva II showed that face-to-face negotiation between two, side of Syrian government and opposition go nowhere, and there is no, common ground for them. So Russia tried to, in favor of Syrian government, try to negotiate with opposition and discuss about common ground that about some, I think, not really what is a principle about transitional government, but about some principle or some point about establishing a ceasefire mm-hmm. and really stopping violence before mm-hmm. any negotiation.
So a milder version of the Syrian government. You're saying that the Russian government is trying to represent Syrian government, but a milder version, probably.
Maybe
so
indirectly, because from the start, I think Russia government and Russia state really show itself that it's a supporter of Syrian government and Syrian, I think, future for Russia is very important as a really strategic alliance of Russia, especially in the Middle East, and Russia really attempt not to lose Syria. And the future of Syria is very important for Russia.
Yeah. Thank you very much indeed. Now let's take a short break. After the break, we'll have Central Stage online search for you. So please do stay with us. Hello again, it's great to have you back with us. It's time for today's Center Stage online search, where we go on the internet for you to pick for you what's taken Center Stage online over the course of the last week. Today we're going to have a look at five websites, or pages to be precise. So this is the first one from Yahoo News. Talks over a little sign of progress toward Syria peace. And see if I
still it's really, I think, the failure of Geneva II or peace process.
Right. Yeah. Okay, let's go to our next web page. Right. Okay, this is actually a new video shows Takfir is beheading Syrian men. I think it's really, I can't believe that in the 21st century people are doing this.
Yeah, it's not acceptable, really, way of gaining any interest, but they exert this way and they choose this way that it's not acceptable for international, I think, community.
I think it's very important for our viewers, particularly non-Muslim viewers, to know that this has nothing to do with Islam. Prophet Muhammad was very kind, even when they talk, we have some quotations out of context of the Holy Quran. They say, okay, you have to fight them, have to kill them. This is only when they are killing you, then they allow
for defense. It's just
self-defense. So basically, I just want to make sure, because if you look at the logo of this group, unfortunately, it has something to do with some Islamic symbols. Yeah. But I think it's very important to mention the fact that this has nothing to do with Islam.
Really, their way and method of really gaining power is not acceptable.
Yes. Okay, let's go to our next webpage. I think it's a very thought-provoking picture, isn't it? Talks over a little sign of progress towards Syria peace and Lakhdar Brahimi.
I think. Akhtar Ebrahimi and a window over there, it shows some, I think.
Some light coming, yes?
Yeah.
Hopefully.
It's about the prospect of the future, because Akhtar Ebrahimi tried to find a solution for Syrian crisis.
Yeah. Great. Next, go to our next web page. So this is actually, Qatari, foreign minister.
Interesting remark by Qatari foreign minister that showed really, I think, a shift, but just in word, not in practice, because we should wait.
For so we have to wait to see whether it translates itself
in the
into action.
Future. Yeah.
Great. Let's go to our last web page, I have to say, and this is from Al Alam. US proposes to include Iran in separate Syria talks. This is a very important development, isn't it?
Yeah, very important development, especially. Because there are I think, especially great power, and especially as you mentioned about discussing about Iranian inclusion in Syrian government and show that without Iran, maybe the Geneva II go nowhere.
So there's a parallel series of talks probably they don't want to accept it. Initially, Ban Ki-moon invited Iran, but then after 24 hours, he rescinded his invitation. But probably now they're realizing that Iran is, whether they like it or not, is an
under the pressure
player.
Of United States. Yes. Yeah, okay. Retracted invitations.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Thanks. Great. So now let's talk about another important issue, and that is actually the fact that Russia says the political transition foreseen under a United Nations-sponsored peace plan doesn't necessarily mean regime change. But Professor Abu Talabi, the opposition insists Bashar Assad must go to implement the Geneva One communique agreed in June 2012 by major powers, which calls for establishment of a power-sharing interim administration.
Well, I would agree that we need a transition in political system in Syria. But again, there are too many questions ahead, not enough answers, obviously. Much has to do with how this negotiation is going to proceed. And as I mentioned before, we definitely need time for new elections. And of course, that could also include the introduction of a new constitution, which may set up a new political system altogether for the future of Syria. So it's very hard to imagine Syria, a country which has been under the Ba'athist regimes for a very long time, will remain as such. Syria is the last Ba'athist regime in the Arab world, and the speculation is that it will not be after negotiations. So pretty much like Egypt, Syria needs a new constitution, but we don't want what happened to Egypt to happen to Syria. That is, there's always the remnants of the old regime who would like to pursue the status quo, and they are pretty much tough to remove. So therefore, there are mechanisms needed to for introduction of new constitution, new elections, and the future course for political development in Syria.
Right.
And yes, right. United Nations can help, but I think we cannot just leave it up just to the United Nations. You know, Russia and United States have something to say about this, and of course, the Syrian neighbors. But I would like to see personally that there would be a transition and not going back to the previous era in terms of military remaining pretty much in charge and not much system in
Syria. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Now, Dr. Hajimina, the first round of Geneva II ended in deadlock. They're planning to have a second round probably in February. Do you think that new round will be any different? We have just 20 seconds.
Maybe, because I think the first round, for the first time, both sides came on the table and tried to negotiate with each other, and not in the battleground. And in the second, I think, round, maybe we found a good, I think, common ground between two sides.
Hopefully. Professor Abu Talabi, just in 5 seconds, do you think that the second round of Geneva II talks will be any different?
I think there is a cautious sense of optimism ahead. And I think because the alternative is so dire, we don't have an alternative. This thing must come to fruition.
Okay.
And I think Prakash's proposal is helpful. Okay. And I think you're going to see better days ahead.
Thank you very much indeed. So I'd like to thank my top guest. We had Professor Ali Reza Abu Talabi, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Wisconsin. Via Skype from the States, and Dr. Rahmat Hajimina, Professor of International Relations and Politics in the studio. As always, your insights are much appreciated. Thanks for coming over, for talking to us, and of course, for those insights. Until next week, from me, our guest today, and the rest of the team, it's goodbye for now. Thanks very much indeed for watching. Thank you very much. Great time.